You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of The Brian Callen Show with, you know, Brian's number one apostle, Hunter Motz. Today we are going to look at conspiracy theories with one of the foremost experts on them. He's written a book called American Conspiracy Theories. It's Professor Joseph Uzinski. Did I say that again?
Yeah, sounds perfect.
Okay. Well, anyway, my Polish is apparently terrible, but I will be working on it, I promise. But yeah, so today we're going to look at conspiracy theories, a topic that needs no further introduction because it's fun and fascinating. Where do they come from? Who makes them up? Are certain people psychologically primed to come up with them? Are there real negative social impacts to them? Are there more conspiracies now that we have at the internet, or are there fewer? What are the social effects of them, and what are the futures of conspiracy theories? So without further ado, I'm just going to call you Professor Joe.
That sounds great.
So, I think that one of the first thing, I mean, obviously, you know, any book responds to sort of prevailing wisdom, and prevailing wisdom is sometimes right, it's sometimes wrong. But I think there's this idea that with the rise of the internet, conspiracy theories have gone up, that there are more conspiracy theories and theorists than ever.
Well, there might be more conspiracy theories than ever, but I don't think that overall belief in conspiracy theories has gone up. And I'll give you one example of this. I mean, for example, the belief in JFK assassination conspiracy theories, I mean, hit its apex in the late 1990s. It hit 80-some-odd percent, people believing that the president was killed by a conspiracy rather than a lone gunman. That belief has come down about 30 points. Now, that's just one conspiracy theory. But what you find is that, you know, the amount of conspiracy theories that people believe in is driven very much by their underlying worldview, you know, how much they think the world is driven or controlled by conspiracies and conspirators. And that remains fairly stable. It's passed down through generations, and it doesn't change much over time. And simply changing the methods through which people communicate to each other doesn't necessarily make them communicate more of one thing or another. I mean, it's absolutely the case that you can find all sorts of conspiracy theories on the internet. You can find a conspiracy theory about anything, but it doesn't mean that anyone is looking for it, and it doesn't mean anyone is reading about it, and it doesn't mean anyone believes it.
Well, and in fact, that's rule 1969 of the internet, right? There's this rule that, you know, if you can imagine it, then someone on the internet believes that the government is responsible for it.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things on the internet that the internet is really just a reflection of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have 6 billion people on this planet putting stuff on the internet. You know, if I type in duck confit, I'm going to get a million recipes for duck confit, but it doesn't mean a million people are cooking duck confit tonight. They're not.
Right.
You know, just the same as I can go find a conspiracy theory that says Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and oil companies killed John Lennon as part of an oil plot, but it doesn't mean anyone else believes it except the guy who wrote it there. So we have to be very careful. It's easy to assume that the internet has this big effect, but there isn't much evidence to say that that's the case. And if you look back through history, every new mode of communication that we have, people always think, you know, it's making the world worse, and things are worse now than they were before because of it, you know. So every social ill is blamed on the internet. 20 years ago, it was blamed on cable. Before that, it was blamed on TV. Before that, it was blamed on radio. But, you know, people are who they are. It doesn't change that much.
And,
just because the methods change.
And Socrates thought that, you know, writing was going to destroy civilization because people no longer had to memorize things. They could just write things down, and that it was going to, you know, inculcate intellectual laziness, essentially.
Yeah. And if you, there are scholars out there who argue exactly the opposite, that the internet has probably injured conspiracy theorizing more than it has to help it.
And that's really what your book does, is it draws together all the research from every domain on conspiracy theories and puts it in one single place so that we can start to get a sense of what is actually known, what is research actually shown.
Yeah, and you know, the Academy is sort of a weird place. You have people who are very much in their own little silos. So mm-hmm. each discipline is its own little thing, and they think their own way, and they talk to each other, but not anyone else. And they're like their own little gangs with their secret words and jargon and whatnot. And they don't communicate to each other. And even when they try to, they often don't do it well. So you've had, you know, historians, philosophers, epistemologists, political scientists, sociologists, communication scholars, all working on the same topic, but none of them communicating with each other. And what we tried to do in our book was to try and pull all of that research together into one larger argument. And what we found by going through everything was that, yeah, most of the research fits together into a cohesive narrative. It's just it took someone to actually do it and kind of compile it all.
Isn't that always the way? So let's talk about, you know, not everything. There are certain, you know, situations that make conspiracy theories more likely, right? That's what the research shows. So could you break down what are those sort of big findings? What is the big story on conspiracy theories?
So there are essentially two ways that we look at people, or two sort of inputs. So you have psychology seems to be a big driver, and things that are external to psychology is also a big driver. So with psychology, we've discovered that there's a worldview, and we call it the conspiracy dimension of opinion. And some people are very high on that scale, some people are very low on it. But we surveyed people, and we found that some people just believe that the world is run through conspiracies. And that's how policy is made. That's how events come about. That's what drives circumstances, is conspiracies.
And
some people just believe that.
And the example you gave was Richard Nixon.
Yeah, so Richard Nixon is a person who was absolutely convinced that the Jews, the academics, the journalists, the anti-war protesters, the hippies, the druggies, that they were
Kennedys.
All working together. Yeah, oh, definitely the Kennedys. They're all working together to get him.
And, you know? And he really brought, I mean, that's the thing, right? And, you know, his White House is really that psychology playing out. It's hardly surprising that he was taping everything, that, you know, he was trying to screw people over, that, you know, he saw enemies everywhere, that he was breaking into the Democratic offices to steal information. I mean, it's...
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and that's how he thought the world worked, because he thought they were doing it to him, and he was going to do it back. And he did all sorts of awful stuff, whether it was using the IRS or the CIA or the plumbers to do stuff, but he did his own conspiracies.
Now, before we connect to the most provocative thing that you've found in your research, I want to take a little look at Richard Nixon's background, right? So Richard Nixon did not grow up wealthy. He didn't grow up in a particularly privileged environment. In fact, when he was in college, you know, he basically divided the world into two camps. There were, I can't remember what they were called, but there were the people who were sort of like the Kennedys. They were good looking, they were good at sports, their lives were blessed. And then there were the sort of, you know, slovenly, uncool people like him. And that's really the mindset that he brought to, you know, when it came to runtime for president, right? He talked about the silent majority, which were these sort of unglamorous people like him, as opposed to the liberal media who were like the Kennedys. And so... one of the biggest findings that you found is that conspiracy theorists are losers. They're social outcasts. They're people at the bottom of the social ladder.
Yeah, and that title can apply to all of us at one time or another. And if you look at the major conspiracy theories in America, they tend to come and go with our politics. And the people who espouse them and communicate them at any given time are the people who are at the bottom rung of power. So go back to the last decade. One of the big conspiracy theories was 9/11 trutherism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that either the Jews or Bush or Cheney or Halliburton blew up the Twin Towers as part of some plot, whether it was for world domination or to take over Iraq or for oil or God only knows what. But most of the people believing in those conspiracy theories were people on the left. They were people who were out of power because the Republicans held power at the time. So that major conspiracy theory was driven mostly by people on the left, Democrats. Fast forward 8 years, Barack Obama comes to power. The big conspiracy theory becomes the birth certificate, mm-hmm. or that he's Muslim, or that he did a whole bunch of other things. But all of those conspiracy theories were driven by people on the right, because they were now the ones out of power, because they got wiped out in 2008. So what you find over time is that whoever's out of power, whoever the loser is at that time, tends to use conspiracy theories. They tend to communicate them, and they get a lot of value out of them.
And so there's two ways of looking at this, of course. It's like, obviously Bush is in power. Of course the conspiracy theories are going to be about, you know, the people who are in power doing something bad. Obama's in power. Of course the conspiracy theories are going to be about them doing something bad. But what you're really saying is that it's the psychological effects of being out of power that generates that type of thinking.
Yeah, and so the people who are going to get involved in those conspiracy theories and believe them and communicate them, those are the people who are already predisposed to have that worldview. But then they're triggered to act on them and talk about them because now they have found themselves at the bottom of the power ladder.
And I want to connect that as well to, you know, we had Dacher Keltner on the podcast who studies the psychological effects of power. And the finding is that power makes people more impulsive and less empathetic. He's got this great study where he looks at, people driving cars through intersections, and people who are driving luxury cars are much more likely to not stop for pedestrians and to speed through the intersection than people who are driving less fancy cars. So there's no doubt that power affects the psychology of the people who have it. But what you're also saying is that power, that lack of power also affects the psychology of people who have it and makes them, you know, more likely to create conspiracy theories.
Yes, and for good reason, too. I mean, there are instances in history where powerful people concoct conspiracy theories and use them, and those are really bad. Those lead to really bad consequences. So think of Stalin, think of Hitler, you know, and the things that they did. So when you have powerful people invoking conspiracy theories, they're usually used against the weakest people in society. So in our country, we tend to find the opposite. We find that it's the weak people, the people who are out of power, are the ones who use them against the powerful. And that's actually okay, because the powerful people, they're, in a sense, immune to these sorts of accusations. The president doesn't really need to worry that birthers are going to come and get him.
Well, I don't know about that.
he's as well protected as anyone could be.
Yeah.
So powerful people are generally protected and they have power, so they don't have to worry about this sort of stuff. Where if the president came out and said that he was going to go after homeless people because they're conspirators and we need to stop them, well, now homeless people really have to be afraid because mm-hmm. they have no power, they have no protection. And it's not necessarily the case that, you know, it's so obvious that conspiracy theory should work that way. I mean, it is the case that pretty much all conspiracy theories are about the powerful or people who are perceived to be powerful. But there's the only reason why that's the case is because there's something in our psychology that makes us fear power. We never hear a conspiracy theory about, you know, that handicapped guy who lives on the corner of the street, or a conspiracy of young school children who are out to get us, you know. So those sorts of conspiracy theories against the weak don't really exist. It's just the powerful people who we think are conspiring, which is kind of weird, because if you go back and read Machiavelli says, you know, the weak are the ones who should be conspiring, not the powerful. Because the powerful have power. They don't need to conspire. They can just use brute force.
But So the first thing that I wanted to connect is, yeah, we had Jared Diamond on the show, and, you know, his most recent book, The World Until Yesterday, one of the things that he noted in spending time with the people of Papua New Guinea is the degree to which they practice what he calls constructive paranoia. They're constantly afraid that a tree is going to fall on them, or that, you know, they're going to slip down a ravine, or that something is going to happen. And that's because there's no medical care to speak of. And so if something goes wrong, there's a really high price to it. But, you know, being paranoid is actually helpful because it means that you're constantly avoiding these dangers before they have the opportunity to mess you up. And that's very much like something you said about the book, about these conspiracy theories. There's a fairly low cost to having all of these conspiracy theories, but an extremely high cost to missing the situations where the powerful are really conspiring against you. For example, the people who were paranoid that Hitler was, you know, going to try and murder all of the Jews probably got out faster than the people who weren't paranoid about that and were like, oh, no, it's all going to be fine.
Yeah, so conspiracy theories, they do provide value for the people who espouse them. So when you have people out of power, conspiracy theories for them can be like a call to action. They can be a call for warning, a call for group cohesion to say, hey, let's get together. Let's watch out for that potential danger. And to be very honest, I mean, our political leaders are incredibly powerful. And if they wanted to do really bad things, they probably could.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unwise to have at least some defense mechanisms, particularly ones that are as uncostly as conspiracy theories. And yes, they are going to, you know, raise a lot of false alarms. And most will not be right. But they do perform a value. And they also signal to the powerful that, hey, the other side's watching us. They're keeping an eye. We have to be honest because we are going to be held accountable.
And to some extent, the powerful then have to respond to those. Like, you know, Obama actually had to respond to the conspiracy theory that, you know, Obama trying to regulate guns as part of some massive plot to ultimately disarm the people and, you know, therefore establish some sort of, you know, communist dictatorship. But he, you know, that belief became so prominent that he had to deal with it. Or the birther belief that, you know, he wasn't actually born in the United States. He had to produce his long-form birth certificate. And the same thing with the Bush White House. You know, they had to create the 9/11 Commission because, you know, so the powerful ultimately do have to deal with these conspiracy theories.
And it's not that bad of a thing. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want the president spending a lot of time, you know, handing out copies of their birth certificate when there are more pressing issues.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, for instance, with Bush, it was probably a good thing to have a 9/11 commission. And that probably wouldn't have come about without, you know, some prodding by conspiracy theorists.
And I think the other thing that's, you know, I mean, based on your political allegiance, you probably feel, oh, these conspiracy theories were legitimate, these conspiracy theories were not. But the function of that may not even be about the specific conspiracy theory, but the fact that the leader is having to be responsive to the people and is having to be transparent and is having to acknowledge their concerns is probably good in terms of dealing with the psychological effects of power on the leader.
Absolutely. And they can have a lot of good just beyond that, too. I mean, when the Warren Commission issued its findings back in the 60s, I mean, it wasn't indexed. It was very difficult to go through. There were omissions. There were mistakes. And it was a bunch of conspiracy theorists who went through it, indexed it, found omissions, found errors, found mistakes. And that was kind of a big thing back then because you weren't able to go, you know, through all the volumes of the Warren Commission report and, you know, search the text with your computer. You didn't have that back then. So having those people do that was actually very good and very helpful. So a lot of times conspiracy theorists, too, will uncover information that we might not have had prior. Even if they're wrong, they might uncover important information.
And I think, yeah, I mean, when you start to view it in those circumstances, I mean, you know, I think there's been a very interesting phenomenon that's been happening in terms of the public's relationship with science where, you know, in the 50s or 60s, there was just a tendency to take everything that scientists said on faith. There was an assumption, oh, these are the high priests, they know what they're doing. And you've seen a lot of conspiracy theories that have developed in terms of, like, vaccines are giving children autism or, you know, whatever other beliefs there are. And it's not necessarily that those beliefs are productive in the same way that I don't think that, you know, the birther paranoia or the 9/11 conspiracies were particularly helpful. But it has changed the conversation between science and the public in the sense that scientists are now much more vigilant and are having to really make sure that the public understands things much better rather than just sort of relying on their authority to win the day.
It's an interesting thing because if you Google vaccine safety, you get a bunch of crazy conspiracy stuff. And you have to ask yourself, why isn't science represented here? Why are these people? Why are we getting mostly non-experts? Why are we getting only anti-vaccine conspiracy theory websites? And it kind of tells you something about scientists that they were kind of resting in terms of their public voice, and they haven't gotten out there the way that perhaps they should have. And I think that in having to combat many of these conspiracy theories, they're doing it now, whether it's with vaccines or on the GMO food issue. They are being a little more forward in some of these things, or climate change too.
Yeah, and we had on the show. We've covered that topic as well. I mean, both in terms of climate change with a book called Merchants of Doubt, and then also in terms of vaccines, Do You Believe in Magic, which was all about all sorts of magical thinking that happens in medicine. I think that's the thing. The scientific community is absolutely much more on notice and is now trying to have to respond. You know, I think scientists believe in rationalism and they assume that they are rational and that everybody else is rational. And so they don't really focus on public outreach that much because they assume that facts will win the day. The facts are there sitting in a huge volume that nobody could possibly ever read, thousands of papers scattered across, you know, website after website after website. And they're like, somehow that vast repository of information, you know, will make its way into the heads of, you know, people who have other things to worry about. And they're now realizing, no, that's not true. And so, yeah, I think there is, you know, ultimately, even though the conspiracies themselves are not positive, I think that it may have had positive effects in terms of leveling the power relationship and scientists realizing that they have to communicate much better in the same way that you're finding with perhaps the birther thing or the 9/11 thing. Those aren't necessary. Birthers and truthers, those conspiracies aren't helpful, but the change in power dynamic is potentially very, very helpful.
I mean, it's strange. I got my flu shot last week just because classes were starting. And, you know, if you think about the whole experience, like, you know, I'm going to stick this needle in your arm. And your immediate response is, no, it doesn't sound right. And it's going to have the flu in it. And I'm going to stick the flu into you. And I'm like, no, I don't like that idea either. And after I put the flu in you, it's going to keep you from having the flu. So, I mean, you know, if there is such a thing as common sense, this would be counterintuitive to that, right? Like, somehow you're going to stick me with the virus that would make me sick, but it's going to keep me from getting sick. And why should scientists expect everyone to buy that explanation that somehow we're going to poke you with all these needles with the stuff in it and it will keep you from getting those diseases and that it's completely safe? But they, you know, and somehow there's an expectation that everyone is going to be like, oh, okay, just stick me.
Well, I mean, a lot of these medical beliefs, I mean, you know, on the last interview, I was just talking about, you know, Everett Rogers, who wrote The Diffusion of Innovations, talks about, you know, this healthcare worker goes into this Peruvian village and is like, there are these magical creatures inside your water. You can't see them with the naked eye, but I promise you they're there. But if you boil your water and then let it cool back down, so it's like you never heat it up at all, the magical creatures will have disappeared. You know, and microbiology, I mean, it's really an act of faith for the majority of us. Most of us have never read, you know, Virchow's work or Pasteur's work or, you know, seen a bacteria on a slide or done any sort of bacteriological experiments. And, you know, we don't realize how most of our beliefs are superstitions and we are taking them on faith. And so a lot of these beliefs that seem crazy, well, you know, we arrived at our own beliefs by basically the same methodology.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I don't fault people for their beliefs. They're free to believe whatever they want. And And I'm fairly forgiving with that, too, because everybody is, you know, a product of their upbringing, and they're a product of the information that they're exposed to. So, you know, if somebody's brought up in a household where they're very, the parents are very skeptical, and then, you know, that's going to be their worldview. And if they're exposed to a lot of stuff on the Internet about, you know, vaccines are bad or medicine is bad, then that's going to be the belief they hold. It's not that they're evil or, you know, wantonly ignorant. In fact, they're just the opposite. They're just getting a very different information flow than other people.
Right. And I mean, in the West, we usually hear the idea that skepticism is just like an all-out good. It's a great thing. But, you know, here with a lot of these conspiracy theories, you're seeing the downsides of skepticism.
I mean, people say, oh, conspiracy theories on the whole good or on the whole bad. And I say it's probably neither. It's probably balancing on the edge. There are positives, like we've already talked about, but there are negatives, too. I mean, they can be used to do lots of harm. They can be a tool used by dictators. They can, you know, if they have something to do with vaccines, and we've seen this at a whole bunch of different locations, people stop getting the vaccines, then polio comes back and measles comes back and whatnot. So there are harms that can come from it. So I think the good and bad is always somewhat in balance. I mean, on the one hand, to go back to vaccines, you know, you're forcing the medical community to justify and to communicate, you know, about vaccines. On the other hand, you are getting deaths by people choosing not to vaccinate.
Well, and for example, I mean, you know, polio eradication was proceeding really well. It looked like we were going to get rid of it. And then this idea developed within the Arab world that, or the Muslim world, that, you know, somehow polio vaccination was part of some vast conspiracy of the American government to give Muslims autism.
Yeah. And there are similar you find similar things with genetically modified food technology.
Mm-hmm.
So go to Africa. These are places where you have the most poorest populations. You know, the people who are most dependent on outside help, but they have lots of land and they could farm. And with genetically modified crops, they could become incredibly productive and they could stop famines and they would have food and it would solve so many problems and you would save lives. You know, people who would otherwise, you know, might starve or have malnutrition or other diseases linked to that. But Africa, a lot of people in Africa believe that GMO are some sort of Western conspiracy against them. And Europe believes that GMO food is some sort of conspiracy, too, and they don't trust the science because of that. And because Europe doesn't want to trade in GMO food, now it shuts down Africa from being able to grow those foods and become productive there with their land. And because of that, you're costing lives.
And so, again, like you have this weird hodgepodge of beliefs where, for example, liberals, you know, really want to help Africans, you know, and so they buy little hemp handbags that have been made by, you know, some woman in Rwanda who survived the genocide, but they are adamantly against GMO foods. And so, therefore, you know, the result of that is that potentially all these Africans are starving.
Yeah, it's a really weird thing, too. I mean, I have attended some anti-GMO rallies, and a lot of the rhetoric there is very conspiratorial. You know, the company Monsanto,
mm-hmm.
who they think is Satan, is purposely trying to poison people, purposely doing experiments on people. And I'm not sure what the draw is to food that's natural, because there's really no such thing as natural anymore. I mean, natural doesn't really have a meaning. So we're like, I only like natural strawberries or natural onions or whatnot. And it's like, these things have been so changed and bred over time that the strawberries you're eating now are nothing like what, you know, our ancestors ate. The corn we're eating now is nothing like corn they had thousands of years ago.
And in fact, many of the natural versions are basically inedible.
Yeah. And you wouldn't want to go... You don't want to go back to that. I always find the paleo diet very funny. It's like, I want to eat like a caveman. And like, yeah, the caveman died at 25. You know, we're you know, the average age now is like 75. By the time people our age are close to death, it'll probably be 120.
Right.
So why do you want to eat like the paleo diet? And why the paleo diet? Why not some other, you know, era? You know, why that one? I don't know.
Well, I'm actually going to start a new movement. It's called the Jurassic Diet. And you eat like a dinosaur.
We're only going to eat dinosaurs. I like that.
And it's you know, it's really inclusive because you get to choose, you know, are you going to be a Brontosaurus or are you going to be a Tyrannosaurus Rex? But there's no mixing and matching. Like either you're going to eat like ferns from the Jurassic period and be like a Brontosaurus, or you're going to eat Brontosauruses. those are your two choices.
The problem is that all the Brontosauruses will have to be GMO. So that...
Well, and that's, again, that's why an article of faith is that GMOs are good. They're universally good.
If you delve a little bit deeper into it, I mean, you just think about, you know, why do people get uppity with this natural thing? It's like, oh, they changed, you know, some of the DNA in this apple. Okay, and somehow the DNA in that apple is going to get into your stomach and then do what?
Get broken down like all the other DNA?
Yeah, it's not like the DNA of the things you eat becomes part of your DNA.
Well, there was that. I mean, let's not forget Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I mean, you know, she became a blueberry. Like, that's a real risk.
But I haven't seen anyone become a salmon or become an apple or anything like
that's
that.
That's because they're a salmon. Like, the person who became a salmon is now a salmon, so they just, like, are swimming with the other salmon. Or, you know, you're just walking along the street and there's a dead salmon lying on the road, and you're like, why is there a dead salmon on the road? Oh, somebody must have thrown out a salmon. You don't understand. It was a person who ate a GMO salmon, and now... they are that dead salmon. So, but I think that's the thing, right? And you know, people, these beliefs are incredibly emotional. I guarantee you that there are people who are listening to this and being like, you idiots, you have fallen for, you know, their beliefs. And it's totally possible that we have, just as it's totally possible that there is a bus on the moon and, you know, Kennedy was shot by some vast conspiracy that may have been perpetrated by the mafia or LBJ or whoever else, and that 9/11 was an inside job, and that Obama was born in Kenya or Indonesia or wherever the hell else. I mean, all of these things could be true, but regardless, there are real consequences to these beliefs. And you know, I mean, like the polio thing, there's a real negative, there's a lot of downside to a lot of these beliefs.
I mean, every conspiracy theory has a better than 0% chance of being true.
Right.
So I don't come out and say that, oh, this one's false and that one's true or this one's false. I, you know, everyone has to assign a probability to every conspiracy theory based on their own beliefs and their own survey of whatever evidence there is. So everyone can make up their own minds, and that's fine. And I don't agree with GMO conspiracy theories. I think they're completely safe, and that's what the scientific, you know, evidence says. If people disagree with that, that's fine. And it may even be the case that their conspiracy theories are driving Monsanto to make sure that their processes are more safe and more inclusive and more visible. And that's fine, too. So there may be something good to come of this, but they have to realize that the downside is that they're making food more expensive, mm-hmm. that they are hurting the most vulnerable populations on this planet. So there is a cost here. I mean, you can't feed a planet of, you know, 7 billion people with organic food.
Yeah.
You know, so those, you know, when you go to Fresh Market or to Whole Foods, and you pay $20 for a pint of strawberries, you have to understand that you're living in the first world and you cannot possibly feed Africa with that, with, you know, with $6 strawberries.
So, yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, there are people, I mean, our sound engineer doesn't necessarily love that idea or agree with that idea, and I think there are a lot of people who would feel with that way, but at the extreme, like, if you think about the crops that wheat or corn came from, right, corn came from something called teosinte, and teosinte is incredibly unproductive. Or if you look at, you know, the original natural potatoes or the original natural tomatoes, there is no way that you could support the world, the planet's population based on those original crops. So the genetic tinkering that agriculturalists have done over tens of thousands of years has, you know, enabled a population of 7 billion. And so it's possible that we need to tinker even more in order to do that. And I mean, we had Matt Ridley on, who wrote a book called The Rational Optimist. And one of the points that he made is that, ironically, if you have GMO food, then you have to have less area of land under cultivation. So the key to having more rainforest is actually more GMO food.
Yeah, and GMO food, too. Once you do that, then you have less fertilizer. You have it actually becomes better for the environment and better for climate change too, because you're being much more productive with less land and there's less waste.
Right, and so you have to decide, what are your priorities? Would you rather dump a bunch of fertilizer in the rivers and then the oceans, which leads to algal blooms, which kills off the fish? Would you rather, you know, clear cut a bunch of rainforests so that you can have more land under cultivation, or would you rather eat GMO food? And then the question is, well, it really does come down to, is GMO food bad for you? And, you know, is it actually going to harm you? And I mean, scientists have been wrong, and so it's possible, but it's always a question of risks. Which risk do you think is more likely?
I can't authoritatively say, you know, oh, it's completely safe, but I, you know, for myself, I eat it and I'm happy with it. And I just don't see where the risks could possibly come from. And no one's ever made that clear to me. And I actually have sat down and read some of the journal articles on this. And, you know, when you take the breath of literature that's out there, and even the unpublished literature, and you put it all into a meta study so that you don't have any sort of publication bias, what you find is that, you know, the science is incredibly clear on this. I mean, it's safe. But when I go to the, you know, when I go to the anti-GMO rallies, it's Monsanto is trying to kill us. They want world domination. They're involved in some sort of evil plot. They've overtaken our government and then governments all over the world. So there's a lot of, you know, conspiratorial thinking there. And, you know, the way people get to that is they start out with, you know, I like things that are natural. I like organic food. And then you add on top of that, that they view the world as operating through conspiracy, then you get these anti-GMO things. Just the same way. I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, medical coverage. Yeah, the doctor's just trying to rip me off, or they've cured cancer, but they're just going to let me have it so they can charge me for chemo. You know, so these beliefs come out from people from time to time, and it's just a question of what their underlying worldviews are, and then applying that to different situations.
Well, and again, and then, you know, interacting with the axis of your political belief, right? So,
absolutely.
You know, are you liberal or are you conservative? Well, if you're a liberal, you're more likely to think that corporations are no good and that, you know, science is messing with our health. But if you're a conservative, you're much more likely to think that, you know, shadowy forces of, you know, the liberal media are somehow, you know, destroying our values and our moral fabric and slowly bringing about, you know, an enslavement of the people.
Yeah, so having a conspiratorial worldview will kind of determine how likely you are to believe in any given conspiracy theory, all else equal. And then your other attitudes will kind of drive you to pick which particular conspiracy theories you'll believe in. So if you're on the right, you'll accuse the left of conspiring and vice versa. If you're somebody who's into New Age stuff, you know, you're likely to believe in Da Vinci Code conspiracy theories, because the idea of a secret bloodline of Jesus, of Jesus's family, that would appeal to you. And, you know, Gnostic stuff and all the kind of things that come up in Dan Brown's novels, that would appeal to you. You know, so it's really our underlying predispositions that we already have kind of drive which ones we're going to accept and which ones we're not. Everyone likes to believe that their conspiracy theories are true and the other guys are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And we all like to believe that we believe our conspiracy theories because we've seen the evidence and the evidence is so good. It's just the problem with that is that evidence is very much in the eye of the beholder. And you could show the same piece of evidence to two different people and they'll come to incredibly different conclusions about it.
Well, so I think
it's
that's
not evidence that really drives belief. It's really evidence and information plus these underlying views that we have.
Well, and I mean, this really sort of fits in with John Haidt's work about, you know, that essentially we have feelings and then our brains go searching around for rational explanations to justify it. So, you know, I mean, he studies, you know, what he calls moral dumbfoundedness, where he creates situations, hypothetical situations that feel morally wrong to people. But he structures the situation in such a way that you know, there's no real rational objection to it. So the classic example is, you know, a brother and a sister are on holiday. It's their last night together. They, you know, get a really great deal on a romantic cottage by the beach, and they decide that it would be fun to have sex together. And, you know, she's already on the pill, but they use a condom just to be safe, and they only do it once, and they never tell anyone, and they feel that it's a real fun experience and a private joke that they will always share together, and they both go on to marry other people and have great, happy families and romantic relationships. Is there anything wrong with this? And people are like, yes, it's definitely wrong. And then you say, why is it wrong? And they say, well, because when people who are related have kids, the kids may be screwed up. And it's like, yeah, but she was on the pill and he used a condom. And yeah, but it would screw up their relationship. And it's like, well, the story says they only did it once and it was a fun thing and they had happy relationships with other people. And, you know, at the end of the day, what you get down to is people are just like, it's just wrong. I know it's wrong. And so it's the same thing with these conspiracy theories. There's a sort of underlying mistrust of shadowy forces. And then your mind goes looking in the reservoir of knowledge that and beliefs that you have in your brain to construct that conspiracy theory. So, for example, there were a bunch of shark attacks. You talk about this conspiracy theory in your book. There were a bunch of shark attacks on the Egyptian coast. Well, if I'm an Egyptian, who could be responsible for something evil and nefarious? Clearly the Israelis. And so they concluded that the Israeli army had genetically modified these sharks to attack Egyptian swimmers. But that is, you know, again, it's a feeling of mistrust and that there must be some evil going on. And specifically, it's a dramatic event, right? These conspiracy theories are usually things like 9/11 or, you know, the election of a black president or a shark attack or whatever it may be. And then the mind races around based on what beliefs are available in your head to construct that.
I mean, we always believe that the conspiracy is being pulled off by somebody who we already didn't like to begin with. So if the oil well blows up in the Gulf of Mexico, Obama did it.
Right, and then
and the Republicans, no, he must have done it, and this is part of his green communist agenda. You know, and if the Twin Towers come down, the Democrats are like, well, Bush must have done it. And that's how these things go. When people see these bad events, they're quick to blame people who they, you know, already hate. And that happens outside of conspiracy theories too. You know, any bad circumstance, we're always quick to blame on things that we don't like anyway. So,
and they're always complicated, but never very sophisticated, right? So, you know, there's like a pattern to all liberal conspiracy theories where it's about oil and money and blah, 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 right? And, you know, there's a pattern to conservative conspiracy theories where it's always about green agenda, communism, socialism, you know, stealing our rights, a violation of the founding fathers, whatever. You know, Arabs always think that the Israeli is hiding under the bed. You know, so there's these things. I mean, they always, yeah, exactly, lead to the same sort of conclusions, which is the guy I already thought was a dick and out to screw me is responsible for all the bad things in my life.
And yeah, and they do it with conspiracy theories. They do it outside of conspiracy theories. That's just how humans are hardwired. I mean, our team is the good team. And we're noble and just, and our intentions are good, and our methods are great. And the other team, well, they're evil and single-minded, and they do bad things for bad reasons, and and we have to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, part, you know, conspiracy theories fit very, very neatly into that, you know, sort of mindset. You know, when the, you know, if you were to show the jobs numbers now to a Republican, they'd say, ha ha, this shows how terrible, you know, Obama and the Democrats are. If you show those same job numbers to a Democrat, they would say, this shows how great Obama and the Democrats are.
Yeah, and always, you know, then it's, I mean, that's the other thing that I find fascinating. I posted on Twitter, there's a statistic that's been floating around around the Arab world that the average Western child reads for 12,000 minutes a year. The average Arab child reads for 6 minutes a year. And, you know, there was the predictable range of reactions. There were some people who were like, oh, crap, this is a really terrible thing. We need to fix this. And then there are some people who start questioning the data. This is not scientific, blah, 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 blah. And some people are just like, you're wrong. Like, we read our own books, whatever it may be. But that, I mean, you know, you could have predicted those reactions based on what people already believed. Now, it turns out, and in the interest of disclosure, it's not clear that that particular statistic is, you know, well supported. Nobody can seem to find like a solid basis for where that statistic came from. But it does point to a general pattern of not a whole lot of reading going on in the Arab world. But, you know, it's fairly predictable where people's minds go based on their existing beliefs. And the real courage and the challenge is to step out of, especially in terms of what our tendency to prejudices are, and be like, if you're a liberal, it takes a lot of courage to go and really read the GMO research with an open mind. If you are, you know, a conservative, it's going to take a lot of courage to really go and look at what are the effects of income inequality, and to not just rely on your prejudices.
And most people will never, ever do that.
Yeah. And thus society will never progress, or it will by, you know, inches rather than by yards or miles.
I mean, there are some very good scholars who are doing a lot of work on this now. And what they find is that when you try to provide authoritative information to people, mm-hmm. about, you know, let's say people thought that there were death panels in the healthcare bill,
mm-hmm.
They don't believe it. They tend to not only just reject the authoritative information, but they double down on their conspiratorial beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incredibly difficult to get people to change their minds once they adopt a particular view of something.
Right.
So,
and I think that's I mean, sort of this. I mean, it does seem like, in some sense, the world is sort of becoming aware of the fact that, you know, we are tribal and we have a tendency to believe the things that we already believe. I mean, there's a dissatisfaction with the echo chamber effect of the internet. You know, the tendency that you like go and you can find anything that you want to have confirmed by somebody on the internet. And that therefore, hopefully, we're evolving a mindset where we start to say, hey, I shouldn't trust my own prejudices because I will always come to the conclusion that I was right to begin with, and maybe should, you know, step back and really examine what the reality is.
I mean, we've had 80 years of social science that's kind of brought us to this point where we now know, you can't convince people of something they don't already believe. People's priors are so strong. The socialization that takes place in our formidable years has long-lasting effects in terms mm-hmm. of our ideology and our partisanship, and then those things drive how we view everything that we see later in life. And those worldviews are so strong that, you know, evidence and information just doesn't matter that much. I mean, it has an effect, but the same piece of information can mean very different things to two different people. And I think what's very interesting there is that finally, I think we're almost getting to a point where, you mentioned John Haidt, but scholars are finally getting to understand this too.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, scholars and journalists are the two groups that believe that this never applied to them. And I don't know why, but these are two groups that are, you know, very much to the left, almost homogeneously so. But they thought, you know, we rise above that. You know, for scientists, they'd say, well, my ideology has nothing to do with this, my scientific findings. It's, you know, that's the point of science, is to remove that sort of stuff. And journalists say, well, we've been We have best practices, and we're professionalized, so our personal views don't come in. But that's garbage. It can't possibly be true. It just can't. And we're in some of Haidt's work shows this now, that him and some others have looked at social psychologists and found that as that field has become almost homogeneously liberal, that the types of questions that they study and the types of findings that they get have become more liberal. And if you look back over time, and this is the same for the study of conspiracy theories too, that liberal professors have tended to concentrate only on conspiracy theories that people on the right believed, and had a blind side for thinking that anyone on the left ever believed a conspiracy theory ever. I mean, if you go back to Hofstadter, you know, he concentrated mostly on people who were on the far right, and said, you know, this conspiracy stuff, it tends to emanate from stressed out people who, you know, particularly people, you know, who are on the right, who are members of the John Birch Society, and that kind of set the stage for how people thought about conspiracy theories. They've seen it as almost exclusively a domain of the right. And that's almost the same today. When my co-author and I started presenting some of our work at conferences, it was us presenting work that kind of pointed the finger equally at both parties, and then Obama is a Muslim.
Well, he is.
Obama wasn't born here.
True.
Obama wasn't born here. So it's like the liberals tend to only focus on the ones that, you know, aggravate them, and that's the ones being held by the right. If you had more people on the right in academia, then you'd have a study of people who thought that George Bush blew up the Twin Towers. But in the 20 years since that, or the 15 years since that's happened, there really haven't been very many studies of that phenomena the way that there has been of the birthers and the death panelers and whatnot.
Well, I think that's part of what's so interesting is that, you know, the more I look at all of this research and read these books, the more you realize that most of what people say that it's unpalatable about the other side, regardless of who it is, has a grain of truth. You know, so there is this, the right has a tendency to say, oh, universities are indoctrinating people to become liberal. Well, it turns out that as people go through university, they do become more liberal. You know, there is a liberal media bias. Well, it turns out that there's actually some truth to that. I mean, one of the more interesting studies that I saw was about TV show coverage versus TV show ratings. So you find that the New York Times writes a heck of a lot about Mad Men. Turns out not that many people watch it. On the other hand, you know, a lot of the sort of shows that do get huge ratings get very, very little press coverage. So there are obviously systemic biases, and that's fine, but, you know, you should acknowledge them rather than denying them. And, you know, in the same way, we had, you know, Richard Nisbet on, and, you know, he studied the differences in Eastern and Western thinking. And, you know, a lot of the things that the East has long said about the West, well, it turns out that there's a lot of research that backs that up, and a lot of things that the West has said about the East, there's a lot of research that backs that up, too. So I think that in general, the sort of larger conclusion is we have to start to realize, hey, we're all groupish, and hey, we all have biases, and once we can start to be honest about that and approach, you know, the research with the humility to, like, give it a fair hearing and an open mind, then we can start to change our own behavior and not, you know, if the evidence says, you know, GMOs are harmful, then that's fine, but we shouldn't reflexively decide that. And if the evidence says global warming is actually real and is man-made, and that's going to be a huge, huge problem, then we should have the honesty to approach that and embrace that.
Yeah. And I think scientists have had a lot of hubris in the past, when you just have one mindset driving it, it people don't see their own biases. So unless they get pushback, they can tend to become they can go too far. I'll give you two examples. I mean, one thing that comes up a lot in my work is this idea of authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a scale to measure authoritarianism made back in the 50s. And, you know, one major criticism of that is that some of the questions there seem to only apply to people on the right. And there's this finding that, yeah, authoritarians tend to exist on the right, but they can't possibly be true. Because if you see some of these left-wing regimes, you see how authoritarian they are.
Mm-hmm.
So when you change the scale and you kind of remove out some of those biases, what you find is that authoritarianism seems to exist on both sides. Same thing with conspiracism. If you just ask people, hey, do you believe black helicopters are coming to get you? Do you believe the communists are coming to get you? Do you think Obama is a secret Muslim who was born in Indonesia? And you say, okay, that's our scale for measuring conspiracism. Well, of course, the left is going to look sound and savvy, and the right is going to look like a bunch of conspiracy nuts.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, it was just a biased scale.
Right.
And there's another paper that just came out now that said that there's been a lot of measurements of, you know, how open people are. And there's been a big finding that shows that conservatives are very closed-minded, but liberals are open-minded and like new experiences. Well, what they found was when you just change the questions a little bit so that they're not biased in what they're asking about and that they're equal between the two sides, what you find is that both sides are equally closed-minded. So, you know, we need more of that pushback. And what we're finding is now that a lot of these things that we thought were just on one side are really just part of the human condition, and they're not solely the domain of conservatives or liberals.
But if anything, I mean, I think that, you know, part of the conclusion is that conspiracy theories are sort of the canary in the coal mine. And what they really tell you is that there's some sort of asymmetry of power, or that this is not an inclusive process, right? So there's been a real asymmetry of power between science and the general public, where scientists just sort of say, this is the way the world is. Now believe what we tell you. There's an asymmetry of power in the media where, you know, the right is underrepresented. And then more generally, like, I think there's, you know, increasingly income inequality. And so that creates a certain asymmetry of power, which leads to a certain number of conspiracy theories among the less wealthy.
Yeah, so that's real. So there are real asymmetries in the world. But in terms of, are the left and right symmetrical in terms of their belief in conspiracy theories? Yes. You know, and that's what my one of the main points from my book.
Mm-hmm.
So people tend to be, you know, or the parties tend to be equally susceptible to conspiracy theorizing, even though one party is always going to have more power than the other at any given point in time, because one will hold office, the other one will not.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing, too, is that the, you know, again, in the same way, a lot of the liberal conspiracy theories don't seem like conspiracy theories because they get good representation in the media. So, yes.
That's right. So it's easy for the left to point at Trump and say, well, he's spouting some conspiracy theories. But a lot of, you know, the mindset of the left is based on a conspiracy, you know, conspiracy theorizing. So if you say, well, we need government intervention in the market because markets are wholly unfair and these big corporations are going to conspire with each other to either create monopolies or run roughshod over employees and either drive up prices and drive down wages, then you say, okay, then we need government to step in and act as a referee and do all sorts of regulation and whatnot. So liberals never see, even when it's spelled out explicitly, they never see that as a conspiracy theory because they see it as absolutely true. So when you have a Bernie Sanders come out and say, you know, the rich are greedy people, and they are making it hard for you to survive, and they are taking over this country, and they're going to do anything they can to keep you down and keep money to themselves. Well, that's a conspiracy theory. You're positing a small group of people who are controlling things, who have rigged the game against you. They've acted in secret to rig that game. They're doing it for their gain and hurting the public good. I mean, that's a conspiracy theory, but everyone on the left says, yeah, that's absolutely true, because it fits into their mindset. Elizabeth Warren says the same thing, and Robert Reich. You know, the game is rigged against you, and the Republicans rigged it. Or as Bernie Sanders would say, the game is rigged against you and the 1% rigged it.
Which is no different than, say, the conservatives believing that there's a tiny group of highly liberal people in the media who are, you know, distorting what our youth believe or whatever it may be.
Yes. And what's even more strange is that you have Bernie Sanders, a Jewish guy, who's there essentially using Nazi rhetoric against the 1%, and no one catches on to this. You know, when you say the 1% are making it hard for you to survive and they've rigged the game against you and they're there's no end to their greed. I mean, that's exactly the kind of stuff that Hitler said about the Jews prior to World War II.
I think the thing is, though, that's a more fundamental aspect of evolutionary psych that manifests again and again. So, again, one of the things that Jared Diamond talks about in The World Until Yesterday is he knew an anthropologist, and she would talk about how, you know, two tribes would peacefully coexist for a long time, and then all of a sudden resources would start to get scarce. And then what would happen is that the one tribe would go off, and they would tell a bunch of stories that were totally apocryphal about how evil this other tribe were, and ultimately, within the course of half an hour or so, have convinced themselves that the other tribe were subhuman cockroaches, you know, stealing all the resources, you know, and going to destroy them. And then that tribe would go and butcher to death the entire other tribe. And there is this real pattern to when people start to feel economically threatened or culturally threatened, they convince themselves that there's some group of people who are, you know, cockroaches, rats, vermin, you know, subhuman, evil, greedy, whatever it may be, and that the only way that we can be safe is to murder all of them, or in a more modern context, marginalize them politically.
And I find that in my data as well. So when you look at who tends to be very conspiratorial, it's people who have been laid off recently.
Mm-hmm.
It's also people who don't have a lot of money. So when you get into those sorts of, you know, can I survive situations without money, that's when the conspiracism can really escalate. And you find less conspiracism with the highly educated, with the very wealthy.
The financially secure.
Interestingly, the three job sectors where the people are least conspiratorial are the government, and the government, military, the financial sector. Government, military, and financial sector. And what's so funny about that is those are probably the three sectors that get the most conspiracy theories hurled at them.
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence. Professor, this has been like so great and so fascinating, and I think that's what's nice is to see the social phenomenon of conspiracy theories and to start understanding it in terms of a universal piece of human psychology of how we behave under environments of threat where it is compared to environments of security. So the book, again, is American Conspiracy Theories, written by Professor Joseph Uzinski. Thank you so much for joining us. And really, guys, read the book so that you can find out about all the wacky things that people believe, which aren't what you believe. And what you believe is 100% true. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Brian Callen Show, validating everything that you've always thought and telling you that you already were brilliant. And so what do you need some podcast to tell you that there might be new ideas out there in the world? Thanks so much for joining us. Feel free to tweet at me, at Hunter Motz, your favorite conspiracy theories. I think it's going to be really, really hard to top the idea that the Israeli army genetically engineered sharks to attack bathers in Egypt. But I'm sure that the fertile hive mind of humanity has created something even wackier.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.